The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome to the Dan Proft Show. So White House counsel Pat Cipollone closed the show yesterday with respect to the White House defense team's opening argument and, God willing, closing argument. We'll get into the question and answer phase today, of course. And I thought his choice to remind senators of the words of some of the House managers from 20 years ago was a good one. He played video of Jerry Nadler, Zoe Lofgren, two of the House managers, as well as Ed Markey from Massachusetts, now a senator, Bob Menendez from New Jersey, and, of course, the celebrated minority leader Pagliacci, Chuck Schumer. Here's what those five had to say just 20 years ago when it came to impeachment.
There must never be a narrowly voted impeachment or an impeachment supported by one of our major political parties and opposed by the other. Such an impeachment will produce the divisiveness and bitterness in our politics for years to come and will call into question the very legitimacy of our political institutions.
This is unfair to the American people. By these actions, you would undo the free election that expressed the will of the American people in 1996. In so doing, you will damage the faith the American people have in this institution and in the American democracy. You will set the dangerous precedent that the certainty of presidential terms, which has so benefited our wonderful America, will be replaced by the partisan use of impeachment. Future presidents will face election, then litigation, then impeachment. The power of the president will diminish in the face of the Congress, a phenomenon much feared by the founding fathers.
This is a constitutional amendment that we are debating, not an impeachment resolution. The Republicans are crossing out the impeachment standard of high crimes and misdemeanors, and they are inserting the words any crime or misdemeanor. We are permitting a constitutional coup d'etat, which will haunt this body and our country forever. I warn my colleagues that you will reap the bitter harvest of the unfair partisan seeds you sowed today. The constitutional provision for impeachment is a way to protect our government and our citizens, not another weapon in the political arsenal.
I expect history will show that we've lowered the bar on impeachment so much. We have broken the seal on this extreme penalty so cavalierly that it will be used as a routine tool to fight political battles. My fear is that when a Republican wins the White House, Democrats will demand payback.
And so payback is where we're at, right, Senator Schumer? Mr. Self-Fulfilling Prophecy? Cipollone went on to emphasize a number of points that were made by House Democrats and Senate Democrats 20 years ago, but focus in on, you know, this thing we have coming up in November.
What they are asking you to do is to throw out a successful president on the eve of an election with no basis and in violation of the Constitution. It would dangerously change our country and weaken forever all of our democratic institutions. You all know that's not in the interest of the American people. Why not trust the American people with this decision? Why tear up their ballots? Why tear up every ballot across this country? You can't do that. They've repeatedly said over and over again, a quote from Benjamin Franklin, "It's a republic if you can keep it." And every time I heard it, I said to myself, "It's a republic if they let us keep it."
For more on this, we're pleased to be joined again by George Perry, former federal and state prosecutor, regular contributor to the Philadelphia Inquirer. He blogs at knowledgeisgood.net. George, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Okay, glad to be here.
So now that both sides have presented their cases, what's your review of the strength of the respective arguments?
I think the president's lawyers have totally destroyed and deconstructed the House manager's case. There is no case, and I thought the way, the manner in which the president's lawyers went about their arguments was really very effective, because not only in the summation that you just played by Mr. Cipollone, throughout their efforts, they used statements by people like Adam Schiff and Jerry Nadler. They turned them around and demonstrated that Schiff is just a flat-out liar, and that Schiff and Nadler and the other House managers had selectively presented evidence and hid other evidence from the Senate. And I just thought that it was a very, very effective presentation by them. And in front of a regular jury, that kind of revelation that the prosecutor had been hiding evidence that was favorable to the defense would be absolutely conclusive. Of course, we don't have a regular jury here of disinterested people. We have a jury that consists of people who have a direct stake in the outcome of the litigation. But still, I thought it was a very, very effective presentation by the president's lawyers.
This notion of executive privilege, right? They chose not to litigate it. The House,
right.
House Democrats chose not to litigate it. The president still possesses it. The U.S. v. Nixon makes clear that it does exist. It just didn't exist in the holistic way that Richard Nixon wanted it to exist with respect to his conduct. But it is a real thing. And so how can it just be waived off by subpoenaing John Bolton if there's questions or topic areas that the president says, well, this, I'm asserting my executive privilege here. He can't discuss these things. The senators can just vote to override the president's executive privilege. Roberts can just wait, can be a one-man one-man high court and make a decision about where the executive privilege begins and ends. That present a complication?
Well, it does, and it would have to be litigated, and it would have to be litigated before the full court. Roberts can't sit as a one-man body to resolve the ultimate issue of executive privilege under these circumstances. So, of course, it could be litigated. But how long will that take?
Well, right.
If you keep your eye focused on the real goal here, what the Democrats want to do is drag this out as long as they can and bring in as many witnesses as they can, because their purpose isn't to remove the president. Their purpose is to dirty up Trump as much as possible and to keep this show alive and going for as long as possible.
Well,
so,
you're going to
have to litigate it.
Yeah, and this is what I wanted to get to with you as a prosecutor, because I don't think this is a point that Republicans have been making about the prospect of John Bolton testifying, and they should be making it, because this is not like, okay, you get one witness and we get one witness and it'll extend the thing for a week. No. If the president exerts his executive privilege, as he did with respect to Bolton's potential testifying in the House, then this could go on for months as it winds its way through, well, the high court, really. I mean, it could go on for a long time.
Yeah.
You would think that would get expedited hearing before the court. But still,
right.
this extends this whole matter for a significant period of time. And that should be communicated by Republicans to other, you know, dumb Republicans, as well as to the American people.
Well, yeah. I mean, all of that's true. All of that's true. It would be heard on an expedited basis, and especially since you got the Chief Justice of the United States sitting in the middle of this trial. I'm sure he could get the thing heard on an expedited basis. But it would have to be a decision made by the entire court. And everything we know about executive privilege, there's no way in the world that Bolton himself should be allowed to testify to conversations that he had with the president as the president's national security advisor.
Right.
That's clear.
Right.
But here we have a manuscript. So what if they wanted to present the manuscript? I suppose the the manuscript is being vetted for national security purposes, I suppose you could say, well, let's put an embargo on the manuscript. All of that is perfectly valid and perfectly true, but of course it gives rise to the smear by the Democrats that any efforts to honor the Constitution and to preserve executive privilege for the sake of the office of the president, not for the sake of Trump, but just for the office, all of that is nothing but a cover-up. And that will be the argument that they will make, not only in regard to Bolton, but any other witness that they wanted to call if at any point. And by the way, there's no way that this would stop just with Bolton. The Democrats will keep coming up with names and proposing witness after witness after witness. And finally, there would come a point when the Republicans would say, no, that's enough. And then they'll still be accused
of
a cover-up.
Same argument, right.
Yes.
He is George Perry, former federal and state prosecutor, regular contributor to the Philadelphia Inquirer, blogs over at knowledgeisgood.net. George Perry, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
Take care.
Grab a good seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. James Rosen got a confab with Bibi yesterday to discuss the Mideast peace plan that has been advanced by the Trump administration.
There was reference in the plan to a four-year freeze on Israeli settlement activity. Do you understand that to apply to both future settlement activity and existing settlements?
No, in fact, the president offers a novel approach, which is the right approach. He says the Jewish communities in Judea, Samaria, our ancestral homeland, will continue under Israeli sovereignty. Get that out of the way. The Jordan Valley, which is our eastern border, will continue under Israeli sovereignty. America recognizes Israeli sovereignty. There is territory, in addition to that, that we've agreed not to change the status quo in for 4 years in order to allow the Palestinians to enter negotiations. I hope they do. So far, they haven't.
But it doesn't apply to existing settlements.
No, it does not.
Key to the implementation of the plan, the successful implementation of it, is whether Hamas will still be there. Is the Jewish state, under your leadership, committed to regime change in Gaza?
Yes, but we're also engaged in other fronts, especially Iran. And I would say 95% of our problems, including in Gaza, stem from Iran.
And one of the arguments that was advanced by President Trump and Jared Kushner, who's been his point man on this, is what the president has been able to do is align the interests of countries that don't necessarily have diplomatic relations, some of the countries that were represented in the unfurling of this plan, around common enemies, align the interests around common enemies, most specifically Iran. Kushner gave an extended interview to Christiane Amanpour, explaining from America's perspective the import and novelty of this proposal.
Perfect. Well, first of all, I'd like to say that today was a big accomplishment for President Trump, something that only he could have done. He met yesterday with Prime Minister Netanyahu, but also with General Gantz, his opponent, in a time of very divisive politics in Israel where they can't agree on much. He brought the country together on what has been the most divisive issue. What he's also done is we've released an 80-page detailed plan. In the past plans, you had the Arab Peace Initiative, which is a very good effort, which is about eight lines. And then you had past proposals, which were 2 to 3 pages of wordsmith documents, really talking about high principles. He also got Israel to agree for the first time to a state, and he got Israel to agree to a map. So what you've seen today is that President Trump's built a lot of trust with the state of Israel. He's done a lot of great things that have made Israel more secure and the relationship between America and Israel stronger. And what he's been able to do today is deliver for the Palestinians a pathway to a state, a contiguous territory, and conditions where they can earn their way to their independence, their dignity, all these different things, along with a $50 billion economic plan that could make them a very, very thriving state in the future. So it's a big opportunity for the Palestinians. And, you know, they have a perfect track record of blowing every opportunity they've had in their past. But perhaps maybe their leadership will read the details of it, stop posturing and do what's best to try to make the Palestinian people's lives better.
Well, perhaps, but of course, their initial response was to reject it out of hand. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by the aforementioned James Rosen, Sinclair Broadcast Group reporter, New York Times bestselling author of The Strong Man, John Mitchell and the Secrets of Washington. James, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
So this is actually sort of remarkable. I mean, the timing of this, but I guess the timing of anything when you have an impeachment trial going on is remarkable. The plan that's been proposed is receiving relatively high marks, even from Trump administration skeptics, at least as thoughtful and perhaps a bit asymmetrical in terms of the normal approach to trying to advance a two-state solution peace plan in the Middle East. But it seems to be received better than one would think a Trump proposal would be received.
This is a blueprint that's 3 years in the making. And as you just noted, it has the imprimatur of the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. It is predicted by few to succeed. We're talking about a plan that would have to overcome 7 decades of armed conflict and distrust. The Palestinians, for their part, say that they really weren't consulted. And the fact is, we always have to remember that since 2005, the Palestinian Authority has been cleaved into two parts. I mean, territorially, it's always existed in two parts, the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. The Gaza Strip is run by Hamas, a group that the United States has designated as a foreign terrorist organization. Hamas remains sworn to Israel's destruction. So any peace deal with the Palestinian Authority is really an attempt to negotiate with two, let's say, Siamese twins, if you will, one of which is really not interested in negotiating. An essential element of the plan is that Hamas has to go from the Gaza Strip. And that's why you heard in the clip that you played, that's why I asked the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, in my interview with him yesterday, which was conducted at Blair House just across from the White House, if he remains committed to regime change in Gaza. He paused, but he said yes. But I then asked him, and this is not in the clip we played, you don't see that happening anytime soon, do you? And he said, well, it could happen. But that's the real fundamental impediment to this plan being implemented, is the continuing presence of a foreign terrorist organization at the head of one of the two capitals, if you will, of the Palestinian Authority right now.
I wanted to get your take on the state of play with impeachment as we're moving now to the Q&A phase of the process. And then ultimately, by the end of the week, the only remaining question is whether or not witnesses will be called. The big news yesterday was the blaring headlines, at least. McConnell doesn't have the votes to prevent witnesses, but there was a subtext that developed later in the day, which is he doesn't have those votes yet. But there seems to be movement in the direction that he will have those votes by week's end. What's your handle on that?
A lot of this is going to boil down, as legislative parliamentary maneuvering often does, to a single figure. And right now, all eyes in the Capitol, where the impeachment trial is concerned, are trained on Senator Lamar Alexander of Tennessee, who is retiring at the end of his term. Because the Democrats, in order to secure the admission of lone witnesses to the impeachment trial, require the defection of 4 Republican senators. Senator Mitt Romney of Utah indicated a couple of days ago that he wants now to hear from John Bolton. Senators Murkowski and Collins of Maine, respectively, edged toward the Romney position, where they had already been. And frankly, these are what you might call, with no aspersions cast, the usual suspects for this kind of defection. And so Lamar Alexander of Tennessee had previously indicated some potential openness to witnesses. And so if he were to make a formal break with that, then the Democrats would have the votes they need. But even assuming that there were to be a vote in favor of calling witnesses, that would not settle what would be the bigger question then, which would be which witnesses. And the Democrats, by insisting on witnesses, have to recognize that this could be something of a Pandora's box for them, because as much as they want to hear from John Bolton, they do not want to hear from Joe or Hunter Biden. And that could be the price exacted for the admission of live witnesses.
He is James Rosen. He is a Sinclair Broadcast Group reporter, New York Times bestselling author of The Strong Man, John Mitchell, and The Secrets of Watergate. James, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Oh, always great to be with you. Of Osceola crying. So blow, Seminole wind. Blow like you're never gonna blow again. I'm calling to you like a long lost friend, but I know who you are.
You're listening to The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. If you live in one of the worst governed states in the country, like I do, I actually live in the worst governed state in the country, and frankly, by the numbers, the country's history, that would be Illinois. But you can add, in terms of terribly governed states, California, New Jersey, Connecticut, New York to that list. I've got some good news for you. That's not something you get to hear very much. Perhaps a ray of hope. And that hope comes to us from this piece in the City Journal by Steve Malanga about government union membership, the public sector unions. Membership in government unions fell again in 2019. That continues a decade-long decline. Workers in the public sector unions now number just over 7 million, but that's a drop of $100,000 people year over year, and about 900,000 people over the last decade. It's a 20-year low. And it also, perhaps, the increased annualized loss of membership reflects the 2018 Supreme Court Janus decision, too, which gave public sector workers the right to opt out of joining a union or paying the quote-unquote fair share fees. And he goes on to say, this is something that's got to be troubling if you're a big public sector union Democrat boss, which is the only kind of bosses there are, the public sector unions. The number of people employed in government at all levels, government jobs, that's bounced back since the Great Recession, but not public sector union membership. The number of local government employees jumped by 100,000 in 2019. So local government employees up 100,000, government union members down 100,000 in the same year. As he writes, the gains have not translated into increases in union membership, particularly in municipal government, the largest segment of public sector employment. Government union membership in California over the decade in question fell by 164,000, though the state now has as many public sector jobs as it did before the recession. About half of all government workers in California now belong to a union. That's down from more than 57% a decade ago. New York lost 123,000 government union members over the same period. Illinois, 45,000. New Jersey down 42,000 and Connecticut down 13,000. Significant. And Malanga goes on to estimate the loss nationally to the two of the bigger boys, AFSCME and SEIU. You throw in the NEA and you've got your three-headed troika. One estimate, AFSCME and SEIU lost 210,000 workers who stopped paying their agency fees because of the Janus decision. So that totals declines are not reflected in union membership figures, but they represent tens of millions of dollars in lost revenues, mainly that go to politics. For example, last year, the NEA spent $70 million on politics and lobbying. Nearly all of it, of course, on behalf of Democrats. They collected nearly $400 million from American educators in 2018. So you could still perhaps be a member. You're not paying those fair share dues because you don't have to. And that means less money politically. And one estimate nationwide, all unions, $1 billion in lost political resources for Democrats from these government unions. And I, again, as somebody who lives in a state that has been decimated by public sector unions, that's how I sum up Illinois. You want me to sum up the destruction of the state of Illinois in three acronyms? IEA, SEIU, and AFSCME. IEA being the Illinois Education Association, the Teachers Union, SEIU, and AFSCME, where they have dominated the political landscape. They have bought and paid for politicians in both parties, and they treat people who are not members of those who are not their members as spare parts to be used as needed to finance guaranteed salaries and benefit levels that are exponentially more than anything that exists in the private sector. And when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more concretely about this, give you an Illinois example that'll make your eyelashes curl. This is the Dan Prof Show.
Exposing political fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Prof, and this is the Dan Prof Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Prof Show. We're talking about the decline in membership of government unions. Shouldn't exist at all. And I'm not an anti-union guy. Trade unions, industrial unions, fine. Real collective bargaining, real adversarial process between management and labor, not the sham in the public sector where the public sector union is on both sides of the deal. They're negotiating with quote-unquote management that they bought and paid for through the electoral process. I elect my managers, I finance their campaigns, then I pretend to negotiate them with them. Taxpayers aren't at the table, and you wonder why politicians write blank checks to these unions. This is what has created kleptocracies in places like Illinois. There's no question about it. Frankly, it's why even big labor Democrats, like, I don't know, the co-founder of the AFL-CIO, George Meany, and the New Deal president, FDR, opposed unionization in the public sector. It's so destructive because you don't have an adversarial process. And you don't have all of the parties represented at the table, like the party that gets stuck with the bill. How does that work itself out? Well, Illinois is an example. But before I get to that, understand how determinative the choice between being a right-to-work state or a closed-shop state like Illinois is, non-right-to-work, is. There's a lot of data because the nation is basically split now. There's high correlation between improved economic conditions and right to work, worker freedom. You would think that makes sense, right? Wherever capital is treated best, it goes. Wherever labor is treated best, it goes. Private sector employment grew by 27% in right to work states between 2001 and 2016, compared to 15% in non-right to work states. You know, almost twice the employment growth, private sector employment growth. On average, the annual employment rate in right-to-work states is 0.4 of a point lower than non-right-to-work states. Concrete terms, if non-right-to-work states had the same unemployment rate as right-to-work states in 2017, approximately 250,000 more people would have been employed. Big numbers. Small percentage, big number. Small percentage of a big number is a big number. Output also has grown faster in right-to-work versus non-right-to-work, rising by 38% between 01 and 16 again, compared to 29% in non-right-to-work states. The gap in manufacturing output is also substantial. Real manufacturing output rose by over 30% in right-to-work states, compared to 21 in non-right-to-work states, and so on and so forth. It's a more free environment, so it's a more productive environment. It's not complicated. Now compare that to Illinois. And the same is the deal in California and New York and Connecticut and New Jersey and some other states. But, of course, Illinois is the worst example. Illinois has the highest unfunded pension liabilities of any state in the nation. It has the worst credit rating of any state in the nation. In point of fact, it has the worst credit rating of any state in the nation since Michael Dukakis's Massachusetts 3 decades ago. And what does this self-dealing I'm described produce? It produces 129,000 Illinois public retirees who will collect pension payouts of more than $1 million over the course of their retirements. Pension millionaires. No, this is 1% of the population, but talk to me in the vernacular of fairness. Talk to me in the vernacular of equity, as the leftists want to do. Lecture me and then listen to these numbers. That's an aggregate. Let me give you some specifics. There is a retired doctor from the University of Illinois Chicago, part of the university retirement system in Illinois. Leslie Heffetz, Heffetz is the name. Retired at the age of 55. Pension she receives, $581,000. The estimated lifetime pension payout will be nearly $22 million. She contributed 768 grand to her pension over her work life. She contributed 768. She's making 581 annually with 3% COLAs that compound. She will achieve an estimated lifetime payout of $22 million. 3.5% is the payment that she that is what she paid in to that estimated lifetime payout. 3.5%. Let's just spin the wheel. Another example. Clarence Bowman, Illinois State University. $410,000 is what Clarence paid into his pension. $386,000 is what his pension is at present. Retired at the age of 60. He will he can expect to enjoy a lifetime payout of $11.8 million. 3.5% is what he paid in to a guaranteed $11.8 million payout over the course of his life if he lives to average life expectancy. You see how that doesn't work? And even if it could, it's immoral. Immoral. I just don't think people have an appreciation for the scams that are being run in government. And the fact that governments like those in Illinois and other states are the last bastions of these defined benefit pension plans. You've got people in the private sector making a fraction of their public sector counterparts and are on the hook to pay 3X and 4X what they can expect from their 401k guaranteed to public sector employees. It's not sustainable. It's not right, and it perhaps is changing as membership in government union declines. So it's a little bit of good news against the backdrop of a lot of bad news in a lot of states that enjoy the title worst governed states in America. This is the Dan Prof Show.
Listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Prof Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Prof Show. Well, we played and discussed Don Lemon's bulletin board worthy giggle fest on his show over the weekend, where he and a couple of anti-Trump consultants had a big old laugh at the expense of President Trump's reputed ignorance of world maps as well as world affairs. And then Trump voters, too. The phrase credulous boomer rube has now been entered into the political lexicon right next to deplorable. You remember.
Obviously, it's false. And look, he also knows deep in his heart that Donald Trump couldn't find Ukraine on a map if you had the letter U and a picture of an actual physical crane next to it. He knows that this is, you know, an administration defined by ignorance of the world. And so that's partly him playing to their base and playing to their audience, you know, the credulous boomer rube demo that backs Donald Trump, that wants to think that Donald Trump's a smart one, and there are y'all elitists are dumb.
You elitist with your geography and your maps and your spelling, even though my
math and your reading.
Yeah, your reading, you know, your geography, knowing other countries, sipping your latte.
All those lines on the map.
Only them elitists know where Ukraine is. Sorry, I apologize.
Oh my God!
But you know what? But it was Rick's fault. I blame Rick.
Oh my God.
But, you know, but in all honesty, but all,
blame
you know what
Rick.
NPR should
Why
do?
Why not? Sorry, hold on. Wait.
Can I tell
give
you
me what, a second? Hold on. Sorry. That was good. Sorry, Rick. That was a good one. I needed
great
that.
Great comedy truth.
Okay, so listen.
Not since Kids in the
can
Hall.
Can I get back to business here?
Have I been so entertained by such clever comedy as that of Rick Wilson and Waja Ali from the New York Times with Don Lemon as the ringmaster there? Well, Don Lemon received a lot of criticism. Charlie Cook over at National Review declared that the death of cable news networks, maybe. It certainly will be for wide swaths of the population, but I guess CNN doesn't matter. That doesn't matter much to CNN. Well, Don Lemon takes criticism very personal, very concerned that anybody would think that he was engaged in the ridicule of any group. So on his show last night, he came in with this.
Final note that I have for you, because this is personally important to me to address this.
So okay?
Anyone, ask anyone who knows me. They'll tell you. I don't believe in belittling people, belittling anyone for who they are, for what they believe, or where they're from. During an interview on Saturday night, one of my guests said something that made me laugh. And while in the moment, I found that joke humorous. And I didn't catch everything that was said. Just to make this perfectly clear, I was laughing at the joke and not at any group of people. So still to come.
And to believe that, you'd have to be a credulous boomer rube. This is the Dan Prop Show.
The fake news. He's always got the real story. This is the Dan Proft Show.
You are fake news.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft. And this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Prop Show. Again, follow us, danproftshow.com, on Twitter, at Dan Prop Show, or at Dan Prop. Can anything stop Bolshevik Bernie Sanders' surge? He's taken on friendly fire, not-so-friendly fire, from Democrat establishment types. He's the subject, or at least his staffers are, of yet another Project Veritas undercover investigation in which James O'Keefe's reporters have Bernie Sanders' paid staffers in South Carolina opining on the sort of staff that surrounds the Bernie campaign.
I canvassed with someone who's like an anarchist, and I canvassed with someone who's, you know, more of a Marxist-Leninist. And so we do attract, I mean, we attract, you know, radical, like truly radical people to the campaign. That's obviously not like outward facing, sort of.
Not outward facing, truly radical people indeed. We've heard talk before from the Iowa Bernie Sanders folks about gulags. Listen to these folks in South Carolina, their recasting of the history of the Soviet Union, for example.
I think, at least my reading of kind of that Cold War era is that you had two massive, you know, you had these huge opposing ideologies and empires and superpowers, and when you have that much power, each side is going to do everything it can to control a narrative and to sort of have its own truth. To support its sort of power structure and things like that. And so I think that if we pay attention to the lived experience of people in post-Soviet states and in Russia and things like that, then we do find that, yeah, like a lot of the stories were told in the United States about, you know, the gulags and the persecution of the kulaks and things like that are exaggerated.
Pogrom denier. Apparently you haven't read Solzhenitsyn too in terms of lived experience, but it is just interesting the staying power that Bernie Sanders has as he goes into the Iowa caucus on Monday as the front runner and the New Hampshire primary a week later as the front runner. I'm always chafed when Democrats provide advice and counsel to Republicans because I suggest maybe it's not coming from a happy place. So I don't want to do that in the reverse. But I do want to have some sense of where this Democrat primary may be going. And to help us do that, pleased to be joined by Brad Bannon, who is a Democrat pollster and the CEO of Bannon Communications Research. He's also the host of a radio podcast, Deadline DC with Brad Bannon, that airs on the Progressive Voices Network. You can follow him on Twitter at Brad Bannon. Brad, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on the show, Dan.
So, I mean, there's you know, clearly Clinton world and Obama world do not want Bernie to be the nominee. There is some on the conservative side, myself not included, that suggests we want Bernie to be the nominee against Trump because we want that clear choice between capitalism and socialism. And this is what my colleague Hugh Hewitt said on Sunday on Meet the Press, that what he's going to do when he votes in the Virginia primary. But despite the support of some Republicans and the opposition to, you know, two of the leading families of the left, Bernie persists.
Yeah, he does. There are a couple of reasons. You know, first of all, I think it's important to note over the weekend, the New York Times released a poll of Iowa caucus goers, and they found Bernie Sanders in first place. But I think the Times headlines reflected the situation pretty well. Bernie Sanders sees his lead in volatile Iowa climate. And the reality is, if you look at Bernie Sanders, Joe Biden, Mayor Pete, and Elizabeth Warren, at some point or other in the last few months, they've all led, been at the top of the leaderboard in the Iowa caucus. So we're talking about a very volatile climate here. A strong gust of icy wind across the frozen cornfields could completely reshape the Iowa race in the next few days. Anything could happen this coming Monday.
Although the intensity, which is an important factor in case it is an icy Monday in Iowa, the intensity seems to be something that favors Bernie, too.
I think you're right. I think the Sanders supporters are very intense, and that may be the difference next Monday. You know, I was a special case because it's really hard for pollsters to measure participation in a caucus, because it's not simply walking into a voting booth, maybe spending 10 or 15 minutes of your time to vote at a police station or a library or something. You have to go out and spend, you know, in very cold weather and spend 2 or 3 hours listening to a lot of people talk about politics. Mm-hmm. The intensity behind Bernie Sanders does favor that kind of participation. So that may carry him on. But one of the things that makes Iowa and New Hampshire unique is they have large numbers of larger numbers of liberal primary voters in the first two states than there are in the states that follow. Also, Iowa, New Hampshire has very few African-American voters. And one of Joe Biden's strengths is his strength among African-American voters. And as we get into the later primaries in South Carolina and on Super Tuesday, where there are larger numbers of black voters, I think you're going to see Joe Biden do better.
Let me ask you this. Is the Democrat primary electorate satisfied with their field, or is there a, as the argument goes, a phobo virus that's paralyzing the Democrat primary per this piece by Patrick McGinnis in Politico, the fear of a better option? Because the early indications when there were all sorts of discussions about Michelle Obama getting in, Hillary Clinton getting in, was that the Democrat primary electorate was pretty happy with their choices. And now there's some suggestion that the reason there's so many Iowans that are undecided is because they're actually very concerned about their choices. What's your read on that?
I disagree. I think the reason why you're right, there are a lot of Iowa voters that are still up in the air. And again, that's why you shouldn't rule out a big surprise on Monday. But the reason Iowa voters don't have a strong commitment to a candidate is, you know, lots of Iowa voters have having a hard time choosing between them. No, I disagree with that.
Your sense is that they're satisfied and they like, I like this candidate. I like candidate A and candidate B, and I'm just having a difficult time deciding which from two candidates that I like. Or three candidates.
Yeah, I think some people are having a hard time deciding between Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, and other Democrats are having a hard time deciding between Joe Biden or Mayor Pete or even Ellen Klobuchar, who is coming up in the polls. You know, if you're looking for a surprise in Iowa on Monday, you might keep an eye on Ellen Klobuchar. She's been
Amy Klobuchar.
She's been steadily rising in the polls in Iowa and in New Hampshire. So if you're looking for a surprise there, it may be the senator from Minnesota. But I just think Iowa Democrats are having a hard time choosing between the candidates that are already there.
What about the candidates that are not there but are in the race? And by that, I mainly mean Mike Bloomberg and his strategy of essentially trying to sort of buy his way through advertisements to a Super Tuesday marker.
You know, Bloomberg has spent well over $100 million on TV ads, but honestly, they haven't registered very much in the national polls. You know, I like Mike Bloomberg. I admire him, but I don't think he's going to be a serious factor in the Democratic presidential nomination.
And do you think with respect to Bernie versus Warren versus Biden, do you think it's really policy differences that are driving the outcome, or is it sort of an energy, a psychic divide in the party between those who want somebody that they're familiar with versus those who want an expression for the populist angst so many feel?
I think there is a psychic difference between the candidates. I look at Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. They represent the wing of the party that I call aggressive progressives. And I think Joe Biden and Mayor Pete and Amy Klobuchar represent the pragmatic progressives. I think you have one group of Democrats who are progressive or liberal, but they're very pragmatic in the sense they want to take small steps to moving forward. Whereas I think if you look at the Warren Sanders wing of the party, they're not pragmatists, they're idealists, and they want to basically push full steam ahead, damn the torpedoes. And whereas Biden and Mayor Pete are very much, well, you know, we need to move forward, but there are a lot of obstacles out there, so we have to be careful.
He is Brad Bannon. He's a Democratic pollster, CEO of Bannon Communications Research, and the host of Deadline DC with Brad Bannon that airs on the Progressive Voices Network. Brad, thanks for joining us on the Dan Prof Show. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on the show, Dan.
Grab a good seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show, and one of the reasons why I think ultimately Mitch McConnell will have the votes that he needs to end this impeachment trial after the Q&A session. Send it to the jury for everybody to vote their shares is because of the quality of the case that's been put on by the White House defense team. And the choice that they made after this New York Times quote unquote bombshell, really a dud, the alleged excerpts from John Bolton's manuscript that has some Republicans openly ruminating again about the prospect of John Bolton testifying and opening the door to witnesses and what form would that take and so on and so forth. One of the reasons why that's not going to happen is because I don't think it's going to happen is because of the choice that the White House's defense team made to address that straight away rather than pretend like this swirl wasn't going on around them with including the public pronouncements of some Republican senators like Mitt Romney and Lisa Murkowski. Saw it the other day from Alan Dershowitz, who took up the assertions in the alleged manuscript. Again, this is a news article that's tantamount to third-party hearsay. And Dershowitz arguing that, look, if everything in that New York Times story is accurate, and it's obviously been disputed by President Trump, by the Department of Justice, by acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney, but let's take it all at face value. Say it's all true. It still is not an impeachable offense. The quid pro quo is not an impeachable offense. It's not a charge. And Jay Sekulow continued in that tradition by raising the Bolton book and addressing it straight away to the senators.
You cannot impeach a president on an unsourced allegation. But what Professor Dershowitz was saying, even if everything in there was true, it constitutionally doesn't rise to that level. But I want to be clear on this, because there's a lot of speculation out there. With regard to what John Bolton has said, which referenced a number of individuals, we'll start with the president. Here's what the president said in response to that New York Times piece. I never told John Bolton that the aid to Ukraine was tied to investigations into Democrats, including the Bidens. In fact, he never complained about this at the time of his very public termination. If John Bolton said this, it was only to sell a book. The Department of Justice. While the Department of Justice has not reviewed Mr. Bolton's manuscript, the New York Times account of his conversation grossly mischaracterizes what Attorney General Barr and Bolton discussed. There was no discussion of personal favors or undue influence on investigations, nor did the Attorney General state that the President's conversations with foreign leaders were improper. The Vice President's Chief of Staff issued a statement, "In every conversation with the President and the Vice President, in preparation for our trip to Poland," remember that was the trip that was being planned for the meeting with President Zelensky, "the president consistently expressed his frustration that the United States was bearing the lion's share of responsibility for aid to Ukraine and that European nations weren't doing their part. The president also expressed concerns about corruption in Ukraine, and at no time did I hear him tie Ukraine aid to investigations into the Biden family or Burisma."
And the presentation of this information straight away is what leads the likes of Senator Ted Cruz to make the comments he did about Bolton and Biden Inc. and Burisma.
"Listen, I don't know what John Bolton's book says or doesn't say. I've seen the New York Times coverage, but at the end of the day, it doesn't impact the legal issue before this Senate. The legal issue before this Senate is whether a president has the authority to investigate corruption. So the House managers built their entire case on the proposition that investigating Burisma corruption, investigating the Bidens for corruption, was baseless and a sham." Hold on, let me finish this. I'm going to finish my point, and then I'm happy to answer your question. The House managers based their entire case on the proposition that investigating corruption for Burisma and concerning the Bidens was baseless and a sham. That proposition is absurd. We've just seen, they said there wasn't a shred of evidence concerning corruption. We've just seen 2 hours of evidence. And at a minimum, it was not only reasonable and justified, but the president, I think, had an obligation to investigate corruption that potentially extended to the very highest levels of government.
Which leads Ted Cruz to this conclusion.
Look, in my view, additional witnesses are not necessary.
Leaves Adam Schiff at his press conference yesterday searching for the rationale to continue this charade, again, on his own terms, of course. And in addition to that, having to respond to the prospect of Adam Schiff being called as a witness.
Are we really going to require the country to wait until his book comes out to find out information that senators could have used to make the right decision on conviction or acquittal? In terms of the sort of red herrings, well, if we're going to call, if the House managers want to call relevant witnesses, we want to call irrelevant ones, because we want to make them pay a price for getting witnesses who are at the heart of this scheme. That's not a game we're interested in playing.
And
I can tell you what my testimony is. He's guilty, and he should be impeached. And I think the idea is an absurd one, but then this is what you have to fall back on when you know just how damaging John Bolton's testimony is going to be. And I would say the same of Hunter Biden. If they want to a witness for witness, then let them call Mick Mulvaney. Mick Mulvaney has said that he disputes what John Bolton has to say. Let them call Mick Mulvaney. Let them call Secretary Pompeo. Let them call people that are percipient witnesses to this scandal and this corrupt scheme. They want a witness for a witness, but that's not really what they want. They want a distraction, and I don't think the senators want to allow their proceeding to be turned into a circus.
It's always fun to listen to Adam Schiff and the ways in which he comes up with to project onto others who he is and what he has done. And I'm sure Republicans are very appreciative of his suggestions about witnesses they could call and on what basis. Of course, Ted Cruz and others, Pam Bondi, who've argued this, are exactly right. It's Adam Schiff and House Democrats that provided the door opening for Biden Inc. and Burisma. If the president did have a legitimate basis to raise concerns about Burisma and the Biden's involvement, the same concerns that were raised by multiple media outlets and former business partners of Hunter Biden and other law enforcement agencies, if they were legitimate to raise, if those concerns were legitimate to be raised by those individuals and entities, then why not President Trump? If it was legitimate for Trump to also raise them, then you don't have a case. I mean, you don't have a case anyway, but the argument you're making in support of your case falls flat. So they open the door to make the Biden Inc. and Burisma relevant and potentially expose Biden, Biden Inc. to be subpoenaed. And of course, Schiff's ex parte communication, at least through staff with the so-called whistleblower, makes him relevant, too. In point of fact, it's Adam Schiff who doesn't want to go down this road of witnesses. They just want an argument. And the point, as I've said before and we'll say again, is no matter how many witnesses you give them, their argument will not change. Chuck Schumer already saying Bolton and Mulvaney or it's a cover up. And then if you give them Bolton or Mulvaney, it'll be Bolton, Mulvaney and Pompeo or it's a cover up. And so on and so forth. All they want to be able to say is cover up, cover, and will say, regardless of what Republicans do, cover up, cover up, cover up from now till November. That's in lieu of the case they never presented because they never had. So sorry, Adam Schiff and House managers and congressional Democrats. You're going to need another quote unquote bombshell between now and the end of the week because the Bolton alleged manuscript ain't going to cut it.
You're listening to The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
Welcome back to The Dan Proft Show. Remember the heady days of the Obama administration and its stimulus program to dig the U.S. economy out of the depths of the Great Recession, of course? Do so through wise investments of taxpayer dollars, in part in infrastructure, but also in emerging technologies and, of course, clean energy. Does the name Solyndra ring a bell? Solyndra received a $535 million U.S. Department of Energy loan guarantee. It was the first recipient of a loan guarantee under Obama's stimulus package. Turns out that Solyndra officials, these were solar panel makers, energy cell makers, used inaccurate information to mislead the DOE in its application and ultimately filed for bankruptcy in 2011, and all of those U.S. taxpayer dollars went by the boards. So, of course, lesson learned there, right? Particularly under a Republican administration. Well, no, the problems persist. Now, this isn't on Trump's doorstep. But the story of Crescent Dunes, which is a Nevada solar energy plant that went bust after receiving $737 million in federal loan guarantees, despite these loan guarantees that were actually harkened back to the Obama era, but were predicated on all kinds of promises about re-energizing a small plant that had been decommissioned a couple of decades ago into a plant that was energy forward, 110 megawatt facility that would be the first of its kind in the U.S. to turn molten salt into power. It never happened. Another $737 million by the board. For more on just the whole renewable energy mantra sector scam in some respects, we're pleased to be joined by Mark Perry. Mark Perry is the professor of economics and finance at the University of Michigan, and he is a Carpe Diem blogger for the American Enterprise Institute. His blog, Carpe Diem, is must reading if you're interested in economic thought and policy. Mark, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, Dan, hi. Good to be on your show.
So, you know, just from Solyndra to Crescent Dunes, and there are many more examples of this sort of thing, and these government gambits persist despite performance.
Well, that's right. I mean, this whole history now of failed, you know, government intervention into the energy markets, and I think it's a interesting contrast. So, you know, the Crescent Dunes, they were able to produce solar power at it was $132 per megawatt hour, and kind of the market price out in that same area is only about $31. So it was costing four times more than the real market price. So again, it's just, you know, kind of demonstrates what happens when the government comes in to try to make decisions about energy markets. And it's a nice contrast to, while this is going on with solar panels and windmills, of course, at the same time, now we've got a natural gas boom in the United States, and natural gas prices are down to pretty much the lowest that they've ever been. And that was an example of an energy market that developed with without any government help or government intervention. That was all private sector, private market, private oil companies, private gas companies that really revolutionized, you know, energy development in the United States. That was not part of any planned government energy policy. So it's a nice contrast to see what happens when the private market develops energy. And they're doing it now at the lowest price in history versus, you know, government financed or taxpayer financed projects that end up being, you know, disasters and costing a lot of money and wasting a lot of taxpayer, you know, resources.
But
even when they can produce energy, it's at a cost, in this case, of four times the market price. So, again, it's just showing what happens when the government gets involved with energy markets versus what happens when the private sector is allowed to flourish.
The industrial policy advocates would say, well, you know, you have to make these government investments to develop the technology because it's not market feasible at this point. But this sort of investment ultimately will bear fruit with helping to diversify and change over our economy away from fossil fuels.
Well, that's kind of the infant industry argument that's used for protectionism and, in this case, in energy markets. But what happens is when you try to develop some infant industry and you use taxpayer money to do it, they never grow up. They remain as an infant because they know they're going to be eligible to keep receiving this. And, in fact, they might have an incentive to fail because as they fail, then they can try to justify additional resources being poured into this bucket with holes in it. And so, yeah, so it just doesn't really make sense then that, you know, to try to develop new industries. You know, the market does a much better job of picking out which industries should be invested as infant, emerging markets or infant industries. The government has a very poor track record of finding and funding infant industries who never become adults. They just remain as infants and child-like firms who are then dependent on taxpayer money.
When we come back with Mark Perry, I want to get the distinction you make between renewable energy and renewable electricity. We'll have more with Michigan economics professor, University of Michigan economics professor Mark Perry, also Carpe Diem, his blog that you need to check out. Be back with more Mark Perry after this.
Exposing political fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is The Dan Proft Show.
We're back with Mark Perry, professor of economics and finance at the University of Michigan, also the author of the Carpe Diem blog over at the American Enterprise Institute's website. And Mark, in this piece that I'm reading from your blog, you talk about these magic phrases that are used by politicians and know-nothings in the media, renewable energy. You make the point that it's renewable electricity, and even more accurately, it's intermittent electricity. Explain what you mean.
Yeah, that's right. So it's a great point, very simple but profound point, that all we hear about is the Green New Deal and, you know, trying to rely 100% on renewables. But really what they're talking about is when with solar and wind panels, you're only going to have renewable electricity, and it's really going to just be intermittent electricity, so you're still going to need backups from fossil fuels. And also all of the technology, all of the infrastructure that goes into solar panels and windmills really comes from fossil fuels and petroleum products. So even if we did go to 100% renewable electricity, we would still need fossil fuels to produce all of the infrastructure, the wind turbines and the solar panels and all of the kind of manufacturing infrastructure that supports those renewables. And then plus, we would still need fossil fuels, because even if we have 100% renewable electricity, we still have to have jet airplanes using diesel fuel, and we still need to have trucks and ships crossing the ocean with fossil fuels. Plus, there's, you know, something like 6,000 products that are made from petroleum products, from oil. So out of a, you know, what is it, I think out of a barrel of, let's see, what is it? So out of a 42-gallon barrel of oil, less than half of that gets used to produce gasoline, and then the other half is used to produce all of these products. I listed over 100 on my blog. And so, again, even if we have renewable electricity, we're still going to need fossil fuels for all of these other products that, you know, include, you know, asphalt and perfumes and motor oil and floor wax and so on and so forth, all of these products that are made from petroleum products. Plus, we're still going to need fossil fuels to build the solar panels and the windmills. And so this whole idea that we could somehow become completely free of fossil fuels, that's just some fantasy pipe dream that's just never going to, you know, be reflected in reality.
Well, it's interesting. And you do list all these products from ballpoint pens to insecticides to clothesline soap, refrigerant, footballs, synthetic rubber, so on and so forth. People don't have an appreciation for it. And so how do you react when you hear Democrat candidates for president saying that one of their, like Elizabeth Warren, for example, saying one of her first acts as president, if elected, would be to sign an executive order banning fracking?
Well, I mean, that would just be nonsensical. I mean, here we have this kind of this miracle going on, this manufacturing miracle, or, you know, this revolutionary situation for these advanced technologies, and it's really transforming energy markets and producing cheap and affordable energy that really fuels our economy. And so to move away from that and to ban fracking means that oil prices would go up significantly, natural gas prices would go up significantly, energy costs in general would go up, it could put the economy into a recession. It would have the biggest and most negative impact on poor people who spend a larger fraction of their, you know, resources or income, disposable income, on energy. So it would really be a way to destroy jobs, destroy the American economy, and then just turn it, we'd probably have to go into another huge recession as a result of those kinds of nonsensical political policies.
Well, and there's also this sort of navel gazing that's done in this country too. You were getting to it, when it comes to not only reducing carbon emissions and being good stewards of our environment, with respect to these innovations in the provision of energy, compared with so many of our competitors the world over that are building new coal plants as we speak. I mean, the EU is building 28 new coal plants. Turkey is building 93 new coal plants. South Korea, 26. Japan, 45. China, which already has more than 2,000, is trying to build another 1,200. And yet we're supposed to just engage in endless self-flagellation about what we're not doing.
Well, it's a great point, because here you have climate puppet, climate spokeschild Greta Thunberg going around to all of the developed countries, you know, preaching about climate change and so on. But I had a graph a while ago, I'm looking at it right now, it's based on data from the Energy Information Administration, looking out over the next 30 years to 2050. And so if you separate the world into the OECD countries, which are the developed economies, and that would include all of U.S., Canada, Mexico, all of Western Europe and Japan and a few other countries, and then the projected carbon dioxide emissions in the advanced developed OECD countries is actually going to be going down slightly over the next 30 years. And then if you look at all of the non-OECD countries, which would include all of Asia except Japan, so it'd be China and India, the Middle East and Africa and parts of South America, their carbon emissions are projected to go up by about 60% over the next 30 years because, again, what you're talking about with all the coal plants being built in China and so on. So I think any kind of attempt to, you know, to preach or have the U.S. or Western Europe move towards renewables is really kind of misplaced. And really, if people are concerned about carbon dioxide emissions, they should be looking at China and India and not the U.S. and Western Europe.
And it's worth noting, too, the innovations with respect to energy in terms of the human impact, because this is from the left and from the spokespeople you're talking about is always about saving humanity. Well, it's the innovations, the technology to be more efficient with producing energy and all the products that are produced from products like petroleum, like you just mentioned, that's actually what's improved the lives of not just improved the lives of tens, hundreds of millions of people the world over the last 50 years, actually saved tens of millions of lives.
Oh, sure. I mean, cheap, affordable energy is a way to really save lives and improve the standard of living of countries. And so when you look at some countries that still don't even have electricity on a regular basis yet, and so they're burning wood or dung, I mean, and then you look at the improvement that would take place in those countries if they moved to cheap, affordable energy, which is really possible with fossil fuels, maybe not so much with solar and wind panels. But yeah, so I mean, people lose, I think, you know, kind of the idea that that fossil fuels and cheap energy is really, you know, kind of the lifeblood of the economy and really has significant improvements in our standard of living that people just kind of overlook, or we're so used to cheap, affordable energy that we don't even really appreciate it.
He is Mark Perry. He's professor of economics and finance at the University of Michigan. And again, his blog, Carpe Diem, which you find at the American Enterprise Institute's website. Mark, thanks so much for joining us on the Dan Prof Show. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very much, Dan.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Prof Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Prof Show. President Trump rallying the faithful in Wildwood, New Jersey on Tuesday evening and saying this to them about what he's doing versus what those congressional Democrats are doing.
We are creating jobs and killing terrorists. The congressional Democrats are obsessed with demented hoaxes, crazy witch hunts, and deranged partisan crusades. It's all they know how to do. The do-nothing Democrats. They have spent the last 3 years, and probably even before I came down on that beautiful escalator with our beautiful future First Lady, trying to overthrow the last election, and we will make sure that they face another crushing defeat. In the next election, we are going to have a victory that's even greater than 2016.
Well, with respect to the contention that Democrats are advancing fact-free cases against the president in an attempt to remove him from office, the president got an unlikely endorsement today from Connecticut Senator Dick Blumenthal. Listen to this. The question he's being asked by ABC News about whether or not Republicans have the votes to prevent witnesses, and much to the chagrin of what the press corps was reporting yesterday about that prospect, here's what Blumenthal said. But listen very closely to all of what he had to say.
Do I think Republicans have the votes to stop calling witnesses?
Right, right.
Based on this summation, a fact-free summation filled with innuendo and insinuation, there's no way that the president can continue blocking witnesses with any sort of integrity. And there's no way that my colleagues can continue to be complicit if they failed to hear evidence. What you just saw was a fact-free summation of a case bereft of evidence. We need the evidence. We need the witnesses and documents. They may have the votes at this moment, but I hope my colleagues will look themselves in the mirror and look at how they will be viewed by history and by their constituents.
There's Stolen Valor, Dick Blumenthal for you. Thank you for the assist. It was a fact-free summation of a case bereft of evidence. A case bereft of evidence. We need the evidence. That is a, I mean, this is an officer of the court. This guy was an attorney general of a state, Connecticut, before he was a United States senator. He just conceded that the House Democrats brought a case without evidence. And now he wants Senate Republicans to provide the evidence that the House Democrats didn't put together. Compelling. Thanks, Dick. This is the Dan Prof Show.
Far from the fake news, he's always got the real story. This is the Dan Prof Show.
You are fake news.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show, and pleased to be joined now by Rich Karlgaard. Rich is the publisher of Forbes magazine. He's a columnist. He's a speaker. And he's a best-selling author of a really interesting book I really enjoyed, Late Bloomers, The Power of Patience in a World Obsessed with Early Achievement. He's written a recent piece that we'll start with on black swans that people aren't talking about. Rich, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Always glad to be with you, Dan.
Well, let's start with this piece that you penned for Forbes recently about Iran and China, and you... apply the Nassim Taleb black swan moniker to both. How do you mean Iran and China as black swans?
Well, a black swan in economic terms, as Nassim Taleb defined, is that unpredictable event that has severe consequences. And so if you look at the coronavirus today, for example, that's no longer unpredictable. It's out there. So it's already, the risk has already been embedded in markets. The black swan is the thing you don't see that could have really severe consequences. And I wrote about two possible ones. I hope neither one neither of them happen, obviously. But one, will there be retaliation by Iran for our drone assassination of Qasem Soleimani, the military leader, a really bad guy? I supported the assassination. But will Iran respond? And if so, how? And I think they could respond. They probably will respond in some fashion, and it won't be a direct response. They're not going to launch a nuclear missile at us or anything like that, because it would be instant retaliation on our part, and it would wipe out the country. They tend to work through militias, and some of these militias have really good cyber skills. And so I speculated, if you really wanted to get back at the U.S. in that way, try to disable the U.S. power grid, which is very vulnerable. Leave the United States without electricity for days or weeks. You'd cause extraordinary panic and economic damage. There would be people who died for lack of food, lack of medicine. All kinds of bad things would happen. And it would be hard to identify who exactly did this. In time, you would, but it would be very difficult.
And with respect to Iran, though, I mean, they're sort of understood to be a regional power, not necessarily with the ability to strike the U.S. on our homeland. Now, what you're talking about is, right, could be done by a small cell of individuals. So that's certainly possible. But that hasn't been Iran's MO in the past, has it?
It hasn't been in the past. It's more Russia did this to Ukraine in 2015. They shut down the power grid. It can be done. And the utility system in the United States, it's old, it's brittle, and there are many vulnerable points of entry. In fact, you know, as we go forward in all industries, you kind of live by the sword and die by the sword in the following sense. If you're not putting sensors everywhere in your complex physical infrastructure and measuring and analyzing everything, you will fall behind your competitors that are doing that. But to the degree you have all those sensors out there that are addressable by the internet, you've opened up just vastly points of attack.
And switching over to China now, I mean, you mentioned the coronavirus. The black swan event you suggest for China, though, is in pursuit of their commitment to be independent of U.S. and Western technology by 2025. And so give us a scenario that you're thinking about there that we should be thinking about.
Sure. President Xi is determined to be independent of Western and U.S. technology by 2025. In some areas, they are the equal of the United States. In some areas, they are arguably ahead, like 5G. They're really good in smartphones. They're really good in some forms of AI, such as facial recognition. Militarily, their technology is thought to be world-class in most respects. But there's one glaring omission in China's technology arsenal. They don't have the ability to make world-class chips, to manufacture chips. One of the reasons they don't is you can't, you know, stealing the intellectual property to build a $20 billion fabrication facility to manufacture 5-nanometer going to 3-nanometer chips is one thing. You still have to build the sucker, and it's hard. Big physical infrastructure, things like that, are hard to wholly steal. Now, there are three companies in the world that are the top of the rankings in terms of their ability to manufacture semiconductors at the leading edge. They are Samsung in South Korea, Intel in the United States, and Taiwan Semiconductor, otherwise known as TSMC, in Taiwan. And so the black swan that I hope doesn't happen is that China stealthily goes for a Taiwan takeover by way of taking over TSMC, a technology they have to have if they're going to be truly independent of Western technology by 2025.
So is that something, like thinking about a scenario like that, is that something that should be on the mind of President Trump and his negotiators when they're engaging the Chinese with discussions of a phase two trade deal?
Yeah, but they might, and they should look. The founder of TSMC, Morris Chang, was born in China, but he's an American citizen, educated in the United States, wonderful man, and very pro-Western, pro-U.S., but he's 88 years old. He stepped down as chairman in 2018. And so you really have to look at, if China is to do this, you know, the stealthy way would be simply to infiltrate PRC loyalists in the upper management ranks of TSMC and slowly begin to do it that way. That would be hard to detect. I do think the U.S. should be alert to this, though.
I wanted to give you a chance to talk about a Harvard professor, Clayton Christensen, who passed away this week. There's a good, because I know you knew him, and there was a good, among many tributes, there was a good piece in the Harvard Business Review by a former student. She wrote of him, in an era of add water and stir solutions to problems, Clay provided something much more enduring. He wanted to help people understand the causal mechanism of those problems, because until you understand what caused your problem, its solution is, at best, hit or miss in its success. Clay liked to say that a good theory applies at multiple levels, and I could see it in our work together. The theory of disruption is as relevant to the steel industry as it is to higher education, as it is to healthcare. The theory of resource allocation is also powerfully relevant to forming the strategy for our lives. And, of course, perhaps Clay Christensen, most known as the sort of father of disruptive innovation.
Well, the first thing I would say about Clay Christensen is that he was just a wonderful man, a prince of a man. I would call him a gentle giant. He was 6'8". And he had this very comforting, slow way of talking that brought everybody in the audience in. There are Harvard Business School professors who are equally famous who are, if anything, they're known for their kind of arrogance.
Imagine that at Harvard, Clay, really.
Yeah, imagine that. What a surprise. What a shock. Well, Clay grew up poor in Salt Lake City, and he was a man who, you know, he was a member and a very active in the Church of Latter-day Saints, and one of the things when he was at Oxford, after attending BYU. He had a Rhodes Scholarship. He was at Oxford, and he was on the intramural basketball team, and their intramural basketball team was in the national championships in the UK, and he refused to play on Sunday. And he said it's easier to do the right thing 100% of the time than 98% of the time.
Yes, right. The interesting thing about what you're describing with respect to him is that that's pops up again and again in some of the tributes to him about him not being so status driven with respect to work, that he enjoyed his work. He enjoyed what he did. He enjoyed the interaction of colleagues and students and so forth. But he also made a point to enjoy family life just as much.
Yeah, you know, and I think that was key to his seeing this disruptive revolution. Now, the word disruption is so widespread, people misunderstand what he was really talking about. And that is, it was the product that was actually crappier, in his, to use his words, you know, inferior to the incumbent products or services. But it had found a market of people who were unserved by the incumbent vendors of products and services. Example, from the 1950s, would be the transistor radio. Transistor radios were really, they were scratchy, they were cheap, they certainly weren't on the same quality level as desktop radios, but there was an underserved market. They were called teenagers. So that, you know, the birth of rock and roll and the transistor radio was explosive. And so these inferior products that serve a market that is underserved have a way of working their way up the value chain, and the incumbents retreat to their higher margin opportunities, and eventually they find, you know, that their whole market has shrunk and the disruptor has taken it over.
Can we hold you over over the break? Because
sure.
I want to ask you a question in the context of your book, Late Bloomers, about the brands that have great appeal to Gen Zers these days. An interesting piece I want to get your take on. We're talking to Rich Karlgaard, publisher of Forbes magazine. We'll be back with more after this. I've been losing sleep, dreaming about the things that we could be. Baby, I've been playing hard.
Grab a good seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
We're back with Rich Karlgaard, publisher of Forbes magazine, columnist, speaker, and best-selling author of Late Bloomers, The Power of Patience in a World Obsessed with Early Achievement. And, Rich, I wanted to start there about your book because, you know, it speaks to this idea of people who find entrepreneurial success a little bit later on in life. They're not a wonder kid who invented a tech company in their Harvard dorm room. But they find success later in life, not just through sort of the experience of trial and error in the professional world, but also through skill set development. And that's sort of an underappreciated aspect of how to position yourself for success in whatever your chosen endeavor is. And I wanted you to address that before we talk a little bit about millennials and Gen Zers.
Sure. I think unwittingly, we in the United States, and by we, I mean educators, parents, of teens and young adults, have created this system that overvalues early achievement from sports to academia. You know, today we kids from upper middle class families and they spend all kinds of time tutoring for the SAT. They take advanced placement courses, all with this idea that where they get into college at age 18 is somehow going to determine the course of their lives. And so you have this misallocation of resources and time and a lot of worry and anxiety that's created over this. And you see it in sports too. You just can't show up in high school for a varsity sport and see if you're any good. If you didn't attend camps and start the sport a lot earlier, you know, you've missed the window, so it goes. Well, it turns out, blessedly, that life doesn't really work that way. We all have different gifts. Many, for most of us, our gifts aren't recognized, so we're seen as late bloomers or not early bloomers simply because our gifts are ignored by a school and education system that over-rewards a certain kind of achievement, your ability to sit down and take tests and do well on advanced placement courses. So it's really kind of tragic for all of humanity that we've got this very narrow spectrum of how we're defining achievement and success for young people today.
And you talk about anxiety, and there was a bit of a funny example, but 7 in 10 millennials consider themselves plant parents, according to a survey that was done. This is the New York Post reporting. While millennial demand for houseplants is high, the poll of 2,000 millennials discovered that 2/3 say taking care of plants is more than a challenge that they bargain for, and a quarter of them are apprehensive about owning a plant because they've accidentally killed one in the past. And now this is angst-ridden, the idea of whether or not to have a houseplant in your home and can I take care of it and so on and so forth. And you're talking about people that are between the ages of 25 and 39. And I don't know if that perfectly dovetails into what you were talking about with respect to the anxiety-induced way in which we celebrate youthful achievement. But how do you react to that?
Well, it's on the surface, it's laughable. When you probe about why this is happening with greater frequency, it's really deeply sad. Over the Christmas break, my father-in-law and I went to the Palm Springs Air Museum, and they have this wonderful World War II collection of both planes in the Pacific Theater and the European Theater. And these docents were explaining on one of the bombers that flew in the Pacific Theater during World War II for the U.S., the old man on the plane was the captain, age 26, and the rest of them were anywhere from 18 to 21. And, you step back and you think about George H.W. Bush being shot down at age 18. And you go, really, we've kind of fallen pretty far here. If 70 years ago, people, 75 years ago, 80 years ago, people were taking those kinds of challenges and succeeding, and today's generation can't deal with houseplants.
Well, and again, back to your book, Late Bloomers, where you talk about some of the skill sets that you're supposed to develop over the course of your life, particularly if your parents have prepared you for the road rather than trying to prepare the road for you. Talking about just
that's
even...
I wish I would have used your words in my book. That's great. Stated.
Yeah, but I mean, but right. So the idea of just being able to interact and cope with other people as well as other challenges.
Yeah. You know, when I was doing the research for Late Bloomers, I interviewed a wonderful woman who teaches freshman psychology at Stanford. Her name is Carol Dweck, and she had a best-selling book called Mindset that came out in 2008. And the idea was we should grow kids to have a growth mindset rather than a fixed mindset. And unwittingly, what we're doing with all these pressures on kids is we're making them brittle. In fact, she said the students she sees at Stanford today, and stop right there, because the kids that got into Stanford got through this gauntlet where they did everything right. Mm. They got really good SAT scores and grades. And yet, at the end of that quest, she described freshmen at Stanford as brittle and exhausted and people who don't want to mar their perfect records. So I think if you don't want to mar your perfect record and you're age 18, my goodness, you have a long life in front of you. You better start getting used to failure and learn how to rebound from failure. And if you don't, you might be one of those 25-year-olds that's
afraid to have a house
plant. Becomes anxious over a house plant because the house plant might die. And oh my God, there goes the perfect record.
A Business Insider recently had an interesting piece about brands and brands across different age demographics and brands for baby boomers that still have the most trust. United States Postal Service, incredibly, followed by UPS, Hershey, the Weather Channel, and Cheerios. When it comes to Gen Zers, so one step back from the millennials, Google, Netflix, Amazon, YouTube, PlayStation. What does that tell you?
Well, it tells me that the millennials are nostalgic. They're nostalgic for a socialism they never had to experience. I mean, they're throwing in their lot with Bernie Sanders, who honeymooned in the Soviet Union and was an outspoken proponent of Fidel Castro and Daniel Ortega, the communist in Nicaragua. I mean, they want it's just sort of this kind of simple comfort food idea. And I have detected the same thing, and I've heard this expressed, that the Gen Zs are coming up, and they're much more independent-minded, more libertarian-minded. When they want to find something out, they go on YouTube. They don't expect it to be handed to them. So I find it actually kind of encouraging, but we've got this millennial dip, and I hope that these millennials grow up. But I think their embrace of candidates like Bernie Sanders is sort of an indictment on their generation.
Well, it is, but does it also speak to perhaps that he's a bit of a Rorschach, and in some ways that Trump was for some demographics too, which is I'm looking for an outlet that is otherwise not being served. I'm looking for an outlet for some sort of populist, anti-establishment, outsider feelings I have that is otherwise not, and there's otherwise no place for it.
Yeah, but the sad thing is such a passive expression, and even when you get back to these brand preferences, they tell me that there's this kind of passive nostalgia. Can't we just stop the world,
You
know, and go back to some ideal version of what it was? And that kind of passivity is a very can be very crippling over one's life.
He is Rich Karlgaard, publisher of Forbes magazine, columnist, speaker, best-selling author of Late Bloomers, The Power of Patience in a World Obsessed with Early Achievement. Rich, thanks so much for joining us on The Dan Prof Show. Appreciate it.
As always, Dan, thank you very much for having me.
Take care.
You're listening to The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
Welcome back to The Dan Proft Show. And Don Lamone, closed his show last night, offered a clarification on the Giggle Fest he participated in the night before, or a couple nights before, on his program with two anti-Trump hacks, in which Trump supporters were referred to as credulous boomer rubes, and all three of the gentlemen had a good laugh at their expense. Don Lemon wants you to know he must not have heard the ridicule, because Don Lemon is not in the business of ridiculing people.
Final note that I have for you, because this is personally important to me to address this, okay? Anyone, ask anyone who knows me, they'll tell you. I don't believe in belittling people, belittling anyone for who they are, for what they believe, or where they're from. During an interview on Saturday night, one of my guests said something that made me laugh. And while in the moment, I found that joke humorous, and I didn't catch everything that was said. Just to make this perfectly clear, I was laughing at the joke and not at any group of people.
Chadwick Moore joins us now. He's the former editor-at-large of Out Magazine and The Advocate. He's a contributor to Playboy, The New York Post, and a columnist for Spectator USA. Chadwick, thanks for joining us. Do you accept Don Lamone's clarification on the matter?
Amazing that is the thing that's made him have to issue a very insincere apology. This is the same man that goes on television constantly to call the president and his supporters far worse things than rubes. They call them hateful racists. And I think that's maybe an even bigger insult. And, you know, he's never felt the need to apologize for that. His wannabe apology does sound extremely insincere and doesn't make any sense. If you're laughing at a joke about a group of people, but not the people themselves, please explain further, Mr. Lamont.
Yeah, right. Yes, it's difficult to parse that, isn't it? Well, here's the thing. It's also just indicative of, as I said, reacting to it yesterday, it's the disdain, the naked disdain that these, you know, from actual intellects of the left and business titans to pseudo intellects like Don Lamone and his friends, the actual disdain they have for people who voted for Trump, regardless of the reason you voted for Trump. And this is just basically a reveal for what they otherwise try to keep hidden so as to not further inflame the passions of Trump voters in 2020.
Right. They don't seem like they can contain themselves. This is another basket of deplorables moment. Where, you know, many people think that was the moment that Hillary absolutely lost the election, insulting half the American population. And their disdain for the working classes, their disdain for average Americans who maybe might not be very educated, but are not, you know, stupid by any means. And It's just this naked hatred they have for these people, and they've learned absolutely nothing, and the entire Democrat Party has learned absolutely nothing in 4 years, and that can just look at the sham impeachment, look at the sham Russiagate. They keep plowing ahead, and increasingly the people are either ignoring them and turning away from them, or they're not buying it. Especially these kind of insincere sort of backtracking of Don Lemon.
Well, the hilarity of it too is you have a display like that in one moment, and then they'll turn right around and lament the state of the polarization in American politics.
Right, exactly. Yes, why are we so divided? Why can't these idiot rubes just be on our side?
Right. Yeah, exactly. We're trying to help you. Can't you see that?
Yes. Don't you understand that we know better than you? We know what's best. Let us help you.
It is remarkable, but there doesn't seem, I mean, you're more in the milieu, the journalist milieu, than I am, and particularly in New York. It doesn't seem like there's going to be any let up of this. And I'm not just talking about directed at Trump. I'm talking about directed at Trump voters, in the run up to November.
Yeah, and that's the amazing thing. And that's why it doesn't seem strategic. It just seems that they just cannot control themselves. It's so deep seated, their hatred. It's so deep seated, their smugness and snobbery, that they just can't control themselves. And if they haven't learned anything by now, they're not going to, and especially by 2020. It'll certainly be interesting to see how the electoral map looks in 2020, considering that the party and their media has done nothing to redeem themselves in the eyes of the American people, and they continue with these this behavior.
When we come back with Chadwick Moore, I want to switch gears and talk about this Washington Post journalist who was felled by a culture she helped create. Felicia Sunmez is her name. We'll talk about her case when we return with Chadwick Moore, who is a columnist for Spectator USA.
Right after my house for the funky coma data. You know what I'm saying? I got every dog in my neighborhood breaking down my door. I got Spuds and Kissy.
Exposing political fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is The Dan Proft Show.
We're back with Chadwick Moore, former editor at large, About Magazine, The Advocate, contributor to Playboy, New York Post, columnist for Spectator USA. And this has been a really interesting story the last couple days in the wake of the tragic death of Kobe Bryant and his daughter and others on that helicopter. Felicia Sanmez, who is a Washington Post reporter, has been suspended for tweets that she sent out in the immediate aftermath of it becoming publicly known that Kobe Bryant had passed away, recalling the 2003 incident where he was accused of rape. Again, those charges were dropped. There was an out-of-court settlement. It just seemed to be poor form in the moment. And now there are a lot of journalists rallying to Sanmez's defense, saying the Washington Post was not justified in suspending her over these tweets. Well, that's part of the story, but you can't tell the whole story about her without knowing that she was one of the first accusers of former LA Times foreign correspondent Jonathan Kamen a couple of years ago in a very dubious sort of Me Too case that seemed to involve a consensual event between the two of them that he regretted, but certainly wasn't of the, you know, Jeffrey Epstein, Harvey Weinstein, Bill Cosby variety. She also has a history of going after female writers, Caitlin Flanagan, Emily Yoffe, The Atlantic and Reason Magazine, respectively. She was, one of the members of the posse that was pursuing Brett Kavanaugh and all of Kavanaugh's writings, and really providing a stilted analysis of old writings of Brett Kavanaugh, like from, you know, Federalist Society meetings a decade before his nomination and ultimate confirmation. So, I mean, she is somebody who has sort of, I think, arguably recklessly used the Me Too movement as a cover to go after political enemies, and now she finds herself felled by a movement that she helped start, in part, not directly Me Too, but the larger quote-unquote cancel culture. And I wanted to get your comment on her case, Chadwick.
Right. Yeah. So yeah, she was a big part of this. So she, yeah, her treatment. She was. It looks like what was happening with Me Too and in Hollywood. Very, very few actual accusations of undeniable rape or sexual assault. Like it seems to be the whole takeaway from the Me Too era was that it exposed just sort of a sleazy culture with a bunch of sleazy people where sex is very transactional and powerful men use it and women would happily go along with it if they thought it would advance their careers and get them movie roles. And now that so much, you know, maybe decades have passed, then they might have some regret about that. And there's a sort of outpouring of maybe grief over choices they made. So when that's the culture and this reporter contributed to that culture undeniably, it does so much damage to actual rape victims, to actual victims of sexual assault, that these people deserve our scorn in a lot of ways. You know, there aren't really any heroes that we can, very few heroes that we can point to in Me Too, and even very few villains, because they all were kind of up to their neck in it in a used and be used relationship with each other. And even Harvey Weinstein, a lot of it looks like that, you know? It's interesting that the Washington Post would have suspended her over this, you know, and the man died, his poor daughter just died. I mean, it's pretty awful to bring up this 2003 case where I don't know what happened, but like you said, he was acquitted, there was a settlement. And here we have it beginning to backfire on journalists who were leading the charge.
Well, it's an example, too. I mean, we're talking about, you know, she tweeted some things, and that now she's, yeah, as she and her defenders are essentially wanting due process for tweets. Well, that's not how it works. That's not how the culture that you created and have exacerbated, that's not how it works. It didn't work that way for Kevin Hart. It hasn't worked that way for a lot of people who may have tweeted something intemperate at one point in time, and you want to end their careers, end their public presence. And now sort of this, she's been hoisted by her own petard. She doesn't like it too much.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And she wouldn't, you know, someone like Brett Kavanaugh, who's now for many people, his name and entire career is permanently smeared by these absolutely made up and fake and ridiculous allegations against him. And what, she's worried about tweets and a job suspension. Okay. Oh, you poor dear. Kevin Hart is a good example. You're right about that. 10-year-old tweets making a gay joke that wasn't that offensive. You know, around that same time, there was I can't remember his name, but an 18-year-old athlete who'd just been drafted to the NFL, who also journalists tried to destroy his career over a tweet he made when he was 14, also gay jokes. So the cancel culture, I guess when it starts coming to the left, and in mild ways it's beginning to, then suddenly they want due process, and they suddenly believe it's really unfair and they deserve a fair shake. Well, sorry, this is the bed you made, and now you've got to lie in it.
This week, Joe Biden has said that LGBTQ rights is the civil rights issue of our time. You know, with Pete Buttigieg being openly gay, how much is the LGBTQ identitarian politics playing into this primary contest, do you think?
Well, Mayor Pete, we only know his name because he's gay. You know, he's sort of like the ultimate affirmative action hire. If he was a straight, white, Christian male, 37 years old, mayor from a small town in the Midwest, there's no way he would be even a contender with how woke the Democrat Party is. And so, you know, Joe Biden had sort of stepped in and said, LGBT issue, civil rights issue of our time. Specifically, he said the transgender issue, and he did this in response to Joe Rogan throwing his support behind Bernie Sanders.
Right.
Bernie Sanders had shared this and upset Bernie's fans because they said Joe's like a notorious transphobe. So here comes Joe Biden to, you know, step in and say, I'm the transgender candidate. Give your support to me. And it's interesting. I mean, it's like, come on. The civil rights issue of our time, it's, the gays have all the rights. It's over. That struggle is over. The transgender issue is completely invented because basically a lot of these gay groups, these multi-million dollar nonprofits like GLAAD and the HRC and Gay Media, they need a new struggle. They have to invent something. They have to invent a reason for the fundraising to come in. They have to get the Democrat Party on their side and have them talk about these talking points, because the gay lobby has a ton of money and they universally support the Democrats. You know, transgenderism is less than 1% of the population. You know, they spread a bunch of myths about violence against transgender women of color, where when you look at the statistics, it's actually the homicide rates. You know, each death is obviously tragic and awful, but the homicide rate is actually lower than that for biological women. So they have to create these causes when really, there's really not much there. And there are more important things that politicians should be talking about in this country, things like trade and immigration. And here comes Joe Biden, who I'm very certain probably has no idea what transgender even means. He can't really remember what state he's in when he's speaking, but trying to jump on that train and take a little support away from Bernie, I guess.
He is Chadwick Moore, former editor-at-large of Out Magazine and The Advocate, contributor to Playboy, New York Post, and a columnist for Spectator USA. Chadwick, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. There's nothing so helpful as your opponent making your case for you. We played last hour of Dick Blumenthal making the case for acquittal accidentally today, talking about a case that was bereft of evidence. We need evidence, which is his basis to demand witnesses. Very confused, particularly for an officer of the court. And I thought Pat Cipollone, the White House counsel, did a nice job, made a nice choice in his closing argument that should be remembered now that we've moved to the Q&A portion of the proceeding. Just playing the statements from 20 years ago to current House managers, Jerry Nadler and Zoe Lofgren. And again, that's walking endorsements for term limits. In addition to Ed Markey, now a senator from Massachusetts, Bob Mendez, still a senator from New Jersey, and, of course, Pagliacci himself, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer. The statements from those five 20 years ago.
There must never be a narrowly voted impeachment or an impeachment supported by one of our major political parties and opposed by the other. Such an impeachment will produce the divisiveness and bitterness in our politics for years to come and will call into question the very legitimacy of our political institutions.
This is unfair to the American people. By these actions, you would undo the free election that expressed the will of the American people in 1996. In so doing, you will damage the faith the American people have in this institution and in the American democracy. You will set the dangerous precedent that the certainty of presidential terms, which has so benefited our wonderful America, will be replaced by the partisan use of impeachment. Future presidents will face election, then litigation, then impeachment. The power of the president will diminish in the face of the Congress, a phenomenon much feared by the founding fathers.
This is a constitutional amendment that we are debating, not an impeachment resolution. The Republicans are crossing out the impeachment standard of high crimes and misdemeanors, and they are inserting the words any crime or misdemeanor.
And now we're to no crimes.
We are permitting a constitutional coup d'etat, which will haunt this body and our country forever.
I warn my colleagues that you will reap the bitter harvest of the unfair partisan seeds you sow today. The constitutional provision for impeachment is a way to protect our government and our citizens, not another weapon in the political arsenal.
I expect history will show that we've lowered the bar on impeachment so much. We have broken the seal on this extreme penalty so cavalierly that it will be used as a routine tool to fight political battles. My fear is that when a Republican wins the White House, Democrats will demand payback.
Res ipsa loquitur, mic drop. Thanks for joining us on the Dan Proft Show.
Far from the fake news, he's always got the real story. This is the Dan Proft Show.
You are fake news.